This is the concert from May 5th, 1978 in Brussels.
F1 F2 F off back to Russia, to Russia, back to Russia, F off, back to Russia.
From the University of Texas at Austin, KUT Radio. This is In Black America.
My family had little or no influence on me choosing this as a career. They were very supportive, but I never sang in church. I used to sing in school choirs and college choir. And then in 71, I was asked to join the New Direction, which was a group out of Washington, D.C., headed up by Dick Morgan, a wonderful pianist. I joined the group, and I really liked being on the road. I liked singing professionally.
The late Phyllis Linda Hyman, jazz and R&B artist. Diva, a reference made to a female performer, usually an opera singer, and the popular vernacular of the music business, particularly in black music circles. The term diva takes on a whole nother meaning. It implies that a female artist is demanding, difficult, uncompromising, and inflexible. It can also be considered a term of endearment, referring to the incredible talent they possess, making them a cut above the rest. In addition to these diva qualities, Hyman was very elegant, statuesque, radiant, photogenic, and jazzy. She was truly a sophisticated lady. Hyman began her career as a silky-voiced, jazz-influenced singer, and gradually moved into slick, heavy-produced urban contemporary ballads and light dance songs. She won a music scholarship, the first given by a business school, and in 1971 she began her professional career with the group New Direction. When the group broke up after a national tour, she joined the Miami ensemble All the People. In 1974, she appeared in the movie Lenny. When Hyman committed suicide at the age of 45 on June 30, 1995, she closed the book on a career that had long been deeply appreciated by connoisseurs of romantic jazz and R&B singing. A commanding physical presence and riveting stage performer, she was a tragic figure beset by personal problems. Never quite achieving the popularity that her gifted talent seemed to justify, she nevertheless left behind a legacy of deeply felt recordings and unforgettable live performances. I'm Johnny O. Hanson, Jr., and welcome to another edition of In Black America. On this week's program, a tribute to the late Phyllis Hyman. In Black America.
Somewhere in my lifetime, you've been here with me. Oh, so close to me. Somewhere. Somewhere in my lifetime, I have kissed your lips, lips so tenderly, they've been kissing.
Cooking, cleaning, and sleeping. And not in that order. Sleeping, 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 cooking a little bit. No, I have a lot of interests, as most people do.
I mean, recording is not your whole life.
Oh, please. God, no. No, are you kidding me? It's not even three-fourths. It's not even half of it. I enjoy what most girls like to do. Pretty clothes, makeup. If I had children, I'd be into my kids, but today I was on a plane coming to Austin, I was into someone else's kid. I love children, I love my old man, I take good care of him, I love men, I love my female friends, I just like to do what normal people do. This is my job, this is a gig. I come to work at a certain time, I do my gig, I leave. It is more intricate and more personally involved. It makes your mind do strange things on you, because you have people idolizing you and you're always being attended to and people are always pushing you. They want things from you.
Tall, beautiful, and talented. Devoted fans of Lake singer describe her as a songstress extraordinaire, with a no-nonsense attitude and a lavish, larger-than-life stage persona. She sang with a life-affirming energy and an emotional intensity found in few other female vocalists. Hyman had one of the greatest voices of her time, and although she did not have many blockbuster hits, her dedicated fans respected her talent as a true diva deserving of wider recognition. Born Phyllis Linda Hyman on July 6, 1949 in Philadelphia, she grew up in St. Clair Village, the South Hills section of Pittsburgh. Hyman was the eldest of seven children. Her artistic style was often described as a cross between Aretha Franklin and Josephine Baker. She began singing while in public school and became a member of the Pittsburgh All-City Choir. She attended the Robert Morris Business School on a music scholarship. In 1975, Hyman arrived in New York City and was discovered by Russ Brown's now-defunct West Side Club. During an engagement, she was spotted by band leader and producer Norman Connors. A year later, he tapped her to sing the lead in his version of the Stylistics' 1971 classic, Bet You By Golly Wow. Nearly 34 years after its release, it remains one of Hyman's most memorable performances. Hyman's first solo top 10 hit came in 1981 with Can't We Fall in Love Again, a duet with Michael Henderson. The song was recorded while she was performing in the Broadway musical Sophisticated Ladies, a tribute to Duke Ellington. She performed in the role for almost 2 years, receiving a Tony Award nomination for Best Supporting Actress in a Musical and winning a Theatre World Award for Best Newcomer. In March 1983, In Black America spoke with Phyllis Hyman.
My family had little or no influence on me choosing this as a career. They were very supportive, but I never sang in church. I used to sing in school choirs and college choir. And then in 71, I was asked to join the New Direction, which was a group out of Washington, D.C., headed up by Dick Morgan, a wonderful pianist. And I joined the group, and I really liked being on the road. I liked singing professionally.
What singers did you particularly idolize when you were growing up or try to imitate when you first started singing?
I'd have to say Nancy Wilson was one I imitated more than anyone. I listened to only a few consciously. Of course, you listened to a lot through radio playing and people who had records on, but consciously, Nancy Wilson was the only singer I would play the records, you know, Guess Who I Saw Today and things like that. And for a long time, I would not perform. I didn't get into the business when I was 21 because of Nancy Wilson. I figured if you couldn't sing like her, don't try it.
I also understand, if memory serves me correctly, your first professional debut as far as the album is concerned was with Norman Connors. How did you particularly get hooked up with Norman Connors?
I was working in New York City at a club called Russ Brown's, and I'd been there about 2 weeks. And Norman came into the club, and he obviously liked me, I guess. You know, I don't really remember what happened, except he asked me to come sit with him and his then-manager. And he asked me to come, would I like to make a record? And I'd made records before, kind of demos, and I had made a solo record before, but nothing ever happened to it. And I thought it would be fine. I was getting paid for it. I'll do it. And if the record had not been a good one, I wouldn't have done it. But I went in and worked with its arranger on Najee Allen Gums. And it was a joint. And it was a big hit for me and Norman.
when did you start taking singing serious, actually saying, well, I have a talent here and I can really make a living at this?
Probably not until a few years ago. Maybe, I don't really think about it, but I would think not until a few years ago. I didn't realize, after Sophisticated Ladies, maybe a year ago, I realize now what it is I have. I'm not sure what it is. I just know there's something that people are buying. So I'm trying to work in every facet of the industry that I can. And of course, up to now, I've done jingles, which are singing commercials for television and radio. And I do concerts, like I was in Dallas and Houston with the Whispers. I do nightclubs, like here in Austin. I do the talk shows, like Johnny Carson, Merv Griffin, Mike Douglas. I do specials like the Martin Luther King special that I did on the 8th, shot in, at the Kennedy Center in Washington, and aired on his birthday, the 15th. And then I did the special for UB Blake, his 100th year celebration. I do it all, anything that helps pay the rent, that is musically respectful, musically wonderful, I will get in there and do it.
What did it mean to you being a part of Sophisticated Ladies?
It was, at first I was very thrilled about it. My initial reaction to my being taken into the show was, I was ecstatic. Then after rehearsal started, I was going, oh, what have I gotten myself into? I signed this contract, it was a drag. It was too many rehearsals. And they don't always spend time with you. Most of the time was spent with dancers, not with the singers. So you had to develop your own style and things. So I was in perpetual shock all the time because I had very little to do but sit around and eat like I'm doing now. But now I eat tomatoes and lettuce and olives. Then I was eating hamburgers and lots of bread, you know. Now it's rabbit food. It was wonderful. Duke Ellington's music stands on its own merit. He is the greatest American composer ever. And who wouldn't be thrilled doing his material?
You're listening to In Black America with John L. Hanson Jr. We'll be back with more of our conversation in just a moment. Now, on with our conversation.
You find Phyllis Hyman being somewhat of a woman that likes to do what she likes to do?
Sure, as most people are. Yet, I do what other people want me to do, too. That's why I'm still in the industry. Otherwise, I'd be home cooking for my husband. I wouldn't. I live with a wonderful brother. Good brother, who's an optician, makes eyeglasses and fashion glasses, designer glasses. He's a sweetheart, and I'd be home cooking and cleaning the house for him. But I can't participate in my portion of revenue sharing if I were to do that, you know. And in order for people to live and survive today, both people have to work. It's not easy out here. So he's real supportive, more than most men have ever been toward me.
How does Phyllis Hyman survive being out here on the road, a single attractive woman, and keeping her head on straight, if there's such a term?
Men don't talk to female singers, so there's no problem. I have no problem whatsoever.
Is there a particular reason for that?
I don't know. Men just don't talk to female singers. I have no idea. I'm told, people tell me it's because they're intimidated and they're afraid to say anything, and they also feel I already have somebody. Well, I do have someone, but he's in Philadelphia. He thoroughly understands. You know, and what is a person going to do? I'm not going to do much more than talk or maybe have dinner with someone or a drink or something like that. I do like male company. I'd be a weirdo if I said I didn't. But men never talk to female singers, not as a rule. Only a real brave man. And I know they're around somewhere, but wherever you are, come out wherever you are.
Does Phyllis Hyman write and produce her albums?
I have written some material, but I've never produced anything on myself other than in the studio in demo form, which is kind of the product that you put together before. Pre-production is what you put together before you do the actual record. I've produced and on that level. It's very time consuming, very tedious, and I'd rather eat and hang out.
Are there any particular arrangers, songwriters, or producers you particularly like working with when you go in the studio and want to produce an album?
I've worked with all of them. Not all of them, but a lot of them. I love them all. Unfortunately, excluding M2Me and Lucas, I've never really had a major smash. I love working with Tom Bell. He's so wonderful. And Nardo, Michael Walden, and I had such fun together. Jerry Peters and my ex-husband, Larry Alexander, and Skip Scarborough. I've worked with a bunch of folks. Chuck Jackson and Norman Connors, all those were wonderful, but they've given me a certain amount of recognition, which I appreciate. I'm just sorry I didn't sell enough records with that, because I'd like to work with all of them again. But we didn't sell a great deal of records. We sold enough for Arista not to give me my pink slip. Pink slip, folks, is like called exit, stage left, you are fired. I haven't gotten that yet, so I guess I'm lucky.
Important for an artist to find a record company that has the backing of the people in power at the record company and having the product in which you produce?
There's no question. Record companies are extremely important. I have been with Arista a few years, and I think this project with Arista, I have great hopes for this project.
That's the Goddess of Love product, too.
No, that's gone. Done. Goddess of Love is done.
New project.
We're going for the new project, and I have great hopes for it. If not, I'm going out of the hotel window. 11th floor, folks, read it in tomorrow's paper.
Phyllis Hyman, being a today woman, what are your other interests besides being a recording artist and a Broadway performer and what have you?
Cooking, cleaning, and sleeping. And not in that order. Sleeping, cooking a little bit. No, I have a lot of interests, as most people do.
I mean, recording is not your whole life.
Oh, please. God, no. No, are you kidding me? It's not even three-fourths. It's not even a half of it. I enjoy what most girls like to do. Pretty clothes, makeup. If I had children, I'd be into my kids. But today I was on a plane coming to Austin. I was into someone else's kid. I love children. I love my old man. I take good care of him. I love men. I love my female friends. I just like to do what normal people do. This is my job. This is a gig. I come to work at a certain time. I do my gig. I leave. It is more intricate and more personally involved. It makes your mind do strange things on you because you have people idolizing you and you're always being attended to and people are always pushing you. They want things from you. I do what I want to do. If I want to be bothered, I hang. If I don't, I tell them, hey, got a gig like you, Jack. I'm going to sleep. Good night. People understand that. If they don't understand it, it's okay.
How does Phyllis Hyman keep herself looking so lovely day in and day out? You work at it?
Makeup, Jack. It's called wash the face, put it back on again. What, work at it? No. I'm blessed with fairly decent skin. Big eyes, enormous lips, folks. Look like the Goodyear tires. Yeah, I have to work at it. I could surely stand to be a lot slimmer, things like that, but one can't have everything, you know? So I just make do with what I have and try to always improve upon it. That's very important for me, to improve upon what was given to me.
In seeing the live performance, it seems to me that Phyllis Hyman enjoy live in-club performances.
I love it. I can see the audience, I can touch them, I can relate to them a lot better than real big TV. You relate to the camera. I just have a live audience, and I do TV because I love television. I want to learn about camera angles and how to work that small lens and what you do. I think the last show I did with Martin Luther King special, I was much more in tune to the camera than I ever have been before, because your movements need not be exaggerated. Exaggeration is for theater and for live concerts. In television, less is better. Less is much better every time. And I've learned that because I don't fling my arms and I'll jump up and down because the camera can't catch all that. It's called stand still, sing, and get down. So now I stand still, sing, and get down, and it picks up very well.
Can't we fall in love again? Can't we fall in love again? We were known as the great lovers. We had the magic from the start. We had so much to give each other. Now you're telling me you lost the spark. Ooh, hold on tight. Don't turn out the light. Can't we fall in love again? With all of my might, I'll try to make things right. Can't we fall in love? The months have flown so fast. A chance of meeting magic's happening once again. The second time around, let's make it last. Come on, darling,
hold on tight.
Don't turn out the light. Can't we fall in love? Let's try to make things right.
What we can do, my darling?
Can't we fall in love again? In love again.
So we live,
and so it goes, baby.
How it will turn out, no one knows. But here we go,
baby.
Final question, Phyllis Hyman. What advice would you have for inspiring young actress, songstress, songwriters, performers of your stature?
I have different answers for different sexes. I would advise women to give it very careful thought. Because of the way society is, because of the way we're raised, because of our mental interpretation of what's going on, I would tell chicks, as a rule, don't hang. It's not happening. It's really... I love it. I love people, but the business really isn't worth it. For a woman's... Oh, God, unless a woman is a real strong, almost arrogant and detached from all emotional involvement, it's very difficult. If there's a girl out there that's got a great voice and has very little emotional involvement with people and stuff, I say right on to it, because she will be successful. Those of us who are very emotionally attached, like myself, who's a Cancer with Sagittarius, moon, and rising, it's not easy for me. Because if my old man said, hey, I'd rather you be home, I'd probably go home. And if I were a secretary, I wouldn't go home, you see? So that's really not realistic, and it's not good for you. But he would never do that. I've known other men that would have. He would never, ever do that, which is making me stronger. If, God forbid, we should break up, I'll be able to handle the next guy with no problem. If he says, come home, I'll tell him, drop dead. Because I don't tell you to come home from your job as an engineer or a gas attendant. I'll let you do your boogie, so don't bother me with mine. But girls have a hard time dealing with that because moms tell them, you're supposed to wash the clothes, darling. Seal, wash the clothes, okay? I want you to wash the clothes. Do the laundry, I mean, cook dinner. And girls today really must dictate their own lifestyles. We can't let our husbands do it, our boyfriends, even our fathers, once we reach a certain age. We learn from our parents, We learn from the male influencers. Bottom line is you must make your own decisions and create your own space. And I've done that over the years, and it's worked pretty good. It's hard. It's very hard because you're very lonely. Women are very much alone. If you notice the guy, the group is here tonight, they have girls everywhere. If you notice it's just me and you. Ain't nobody here but you and I, you know? I mean, this is work. Men don't come around female performers. Just don't do it.
This body was sweat when I got the juice. I'm just a girl with the play, loving on the loose. You see, you're the kind of man that needs my affection, my love and protection, but to be a perfection. Don't be fronting on me, you know who I am. Other sisters you do, just don't give a damn. So brother, I don't want to change your world. All I want to do is be your girl. Understand what I'm saying?
I want to be your girl.
This has been a tribute to the late Phyllis Linda Hyman, singer, songwriter, and actress. Hyman died on June 30th, 1995, at the age of 45. If you have questions, comments, or suggestions as to future In Black America programs, email us at inblackamerica@kut.org. Also, let us know what radio station you heard us over. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook and Twitter. You can hear previous programs online at KUT.org. Also, you can listen to a special collection of In Black America programs at American Archive of Public Broadcasting. That's AmericanArchives.org. The views and opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of this station or of the University of Texas at Austin. Until we have the opportunity again for technical producer David Alvarez, I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr. Thank you for joining us today. Please join us again next week.
CD copies of this program are available and may be purchased by writing In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. That's In Black America CDs, KUT Radio, One University Station, Austin, Texas, 78712. This has been a production of KUT Radio.
In Black America and KUT Public Radio are members of the NPR Network. It's an independent coalition of public media podcasters helping to bring diversity to the airwaves. You can find more shows like In Black America in the NPR Network in your favorite podcast app. I'm Johnny L. Hansen, Jr.
Hi, this is Kevin Amos, and you're listening to WRCT Pittsburgh. This is Ebony Spectrum.
It's Monday, so I'm keep it black, but I'm gonna keep it brief. Today is National Crown Day, everybody. What's that? It's a day named for the Crown Act, which stands for creating a respectful and open world for natural hair. Black folks know they love an acronym. It's a law that prohibits race-based hair discrimination based on hair texture and protective styles such as braids, locks, twists, and knots. Now, show of hands for anybody who has personally been victimized by hair discrimination in the workplace or at school. Well, today and every day after, we say, wear the protective style, sis. And not just women, everybody black. Because for forever, we was just out here with no backup, no support from HR or the higher-ups, just having to change ourselves and appearances for the approval of the man? Well, no longer. Crown Act was first introduced in California by Senator Holly Mitchell and signed by Governor Newsom on July 3rd, 2019. This set off a chain reaction across the country, and now 23 states have passed the Crown Act. And it's really refreshing to me because you would think that something that historically has only ever affected black people due to the unique makeup of our hair and all the fantastic things we can do with it, that nobody would make a fuss about it. Because let's walk it back a few steps. In recent years, we've heard viral stories like Faith Finity's, a sixth grader who was sent home from school because of her braids. CJ Stanley, a first grader who was denied entry on the first day of school due to his locks. Andrew Johnson, a high school wrestler in New Jersey who was forced to either cut his hair or forfeit his match. Chastity Jones was asked to cut her locks for a corporate position, and when she refused, they rescinded her offer. And when she tried to take it to court in 2018, the Supreme Court refused to even consider it, and thus basically granted employers permission to ban most, if not all, natural and protective hairstyles. In 2021, World Aquatics, the international governing body of international water sports, rejected a swim cap designed specifically for natural hair at the Olympics because it didn't fit the natural shape of the head. And even if we didn't have these viral episodes, we know hair discrimination and tactics to avoid it to have been woven into our everyday lives for some time. Many an HBCU grad has found it necessary to cut off their locks to even enter corporate America. Hell, we can barely fit graduation caps, and many of us have been told how we can or cannot wear our hair if we want to walk. And much of this hair discrimination in favor of a cleaner hair look, does not even consider that black hair is susceptible to breakage and hair damage by the overuse of blow dryers, flat irons, and chemical relaxers, all of which we have to use excessively to keep our hair in line. Because by nature, our hair is determined to stand up. And don't get me started on how we just found out decades later that perms can cause cancer. Lord have mercy. Thus, braids, locks, twists, and knots, collectively protective hairstyles, are necessary for healthy black hair maintenance. Anywho, at some point, Dove, yes, the soap, said we've seen enough. Let's put some numbers behind this phenomenon. And in 2019, they presented their initial Crown Workplace Research Study, and oh, buddy. This study found that black women are made to be more aware of office grooming policies at a higher rate than white women. 80% of the black women surveyed agreed with the statement, I have to change my hair from its natural state to fit in at the office, and that their hair was 3.4 times more likely to be perceived as unprofessional. In 2021, the Crown Research Study for Girls found that 53% of black mothers whose daughters have experienced hair discrimination reported that their daughters had experienced it by the age of 5. And this year, in 2023, the research study found that black women's hair was still 2.5 times more likely to be perceived as unprofessional. Which is crazy to me, because we got a judge appointed to the highest court in the land with sister locks. Ha ha! Ketanji! Black women with locks, natural protective styles, are disproportionately sent home, fired, dismissed, and even punished at school for this. So Judge Jackson, we thank you for being you. Tanisha Meeks, thank you for eating down on Chloe and Halle Bailey's hair and adjusting their crowns to highlight the versatility and overall appeal of black hair and locks specifically. Especially after somebody tried to play you and Zendaya, talking about her hair looked like it smelled like patchouli oil and weed. Huh? And I already know what's coming. It's just hair. Why y'all can't change it? Well, because y'all dubbed our hair unruly, unkempt, uncivilized, nappy, conditioned us, forced see girls to engage in negative self-talk and adopt anti-black ideals when it comes to self-image. Y'all created intimate ties between texturism and colorism, from paper bag tests to hot combs and perms. And the truth of it is that all of these things, problematic as they may be, have been a part of our cultural processes and our journey, showing that anything you can do, we can do better. Cause period. But Miss Madam CJ Walker and Miss Annie Malone, we thank you for your efforts, but we's free now. Ooh, wait a minute. You dropped this.
We want to get your feedback to our upcoming series, Black Women Doing Stuff.
Nope. Yeah, pause that shit.
I have notes.
Oh, okay. Opinions already. Great. Okay. Why don't you tell me what you see?
Actually, sister, it's what we didn't see. The whole black female self. A show about black women, and the first thing you show us is a disembodied leg?
Oh, okay. Well, I see what you're saying, but, you know, she's just getting out of the car. The shot's not going to linger there.
In a Lexus? Yuck. I mean, is she poor? Why not have her drive a black Jaguar?
Uh-uh. Don't link black women with cats. We are not catty.
Where is she? Look like Rhode Island or some shit. Ain't no black people in Rhode Island.
Okay, got it. No black folks in Rhode Island.
There absolutely are black people in Rhode Island. My husband and I are adjuncts at Brown University, which is a university.
Understood. Okay, all professors in Rhode Island are black.
And where is Miss Legg even from? Are classy people from the diaspora excluded from this experience?
If she's not a descendant of enslaved peoples, I don't know why I am here.
Yes, I'm hearing all of you. This is great. Any positive notes before we move on to the 58 minutes left in this episode?
Did she go to public school?
Why she got on heels? Real niggas wear Jordans.
Skin's a little light to be dark skin. A little dark to be light skin.
Why only 1 foot? Are you trying to say that black women can afford 2 feet?
And why is she styled to attract a man?
Why wouldn't she be styled to attract a man?
I don't dress for niggas. Plus, my nigga's a girl. Yo, why she ain't got a girl nigga? Black women are gay too.
Wow. Okay, I didn't expect so many opinions. My hand hurts. But that's okay, because now we are equipped to make the woke but playful, elitist but not classist, hood but not wearing a bonnet in public, upper middle, lower class, deep but not shallow, and funny but also serious, and natural but with fillers. Show about black women that you all want to see.
Hey, what channel is this gonna be on? YouTube? I only have Netflix, but I only watch Wheel of Fortune. Is this gonna be on Wheel of Fortune?
You know what? Why don't we just have you back in a couple weeks to see what we've come up with?
I'm happy your pen is black.
What about Wheel of Fortune?
And this better not have Tokyo Tony.
Trust me, we got it. After taking into account all of your concerns and criticisms, we realize there's really only one black woman any of you wanna see on screen. So we gave you what you're looking for.
Does she think she is?
Nope. Problematic.
So cringy.
She thinks she's better than me.
I'm triggered. Y'all weird for this.
No, she would never make it into Soho House looking like that.
This is too gay, but also not gay enough. Throw the whole thing away.
This is violence.
I don't know why, but this is making me mad.
Leaders of Western military powers have gathered in Vilnius, Lithuania, for NATO's annual summit, with Russia's war in Ukraine central to the discussions. On the eve of the summit, Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan said he would drop his opposition to Sweden's bid to join NATO, clearing the way for its accession as the alliance's 32nd member. Following the announcement, Biden administration says it will move ahead with the transfer of F-16 fighter jets to Turkey, pending congressional approval. Earlier today, President Biden spoke briefly to reporters alongside NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg.
And this historic moment, the adding of Finland and Sweden to NATO is consequential, and your leadership really matters.
Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky is scheduled to meet with President Biden at the NATO summit Wednesday. Ahead of the meeting, he accused NATO members of ignoring Ukraine's bid to join the alliance, writing, quote, "It's unprecedented and absurd when time frame is not set neither for the invitation nor for Ukraine's membership. It seems there's no readiness neither to invite Ukraine to NATO nor to make it a member of the alliance," he said. We'll have more on the NATO summit and Russia's war in Ukraine after headlines. Russia launched missile and drone attacks on Ukraine's capital Kyiv in the southern port of Odessa overnight. The airstrikes followed a Russian attack on a humanitarian aid distribution center in southeastern Ukraine that killed 7 people. In Russia, the Kremlin said Monday the embattled leader of the Wagner mercenary group met in Moscow with Russian President Vladimir Putin last month, 5 days after the Wagner forces launched a failed mutiny. Kremlin spokesperson Dmitry Peskov said Wagner chief Evgeny Prigozhin was part of a 3-hour meeting on June 29th involving nearly 36 other Wagner leaders.
The commanders provided their account of what happened. They stressed the fact that they are loyal supporters and soldiers of the head of state and the commander in chief. They said they were ready to carry on fighting for their motherland.
President Biden's declared a state of emergency in Vermont, where authorities have closed off downtown areas of the capital, Montpelier, after 2 months' worth of rain fell in less than 48 hours. Vermont's rivers are expected to crest today at about 20 feet above normal, the state's worst flooding since 1927. In New York, Governor Kathy Hochul said this week storms dumped up to 8 inches of rain, causing flash flooding in parts of Hudson Valley and Finger Lakes regions. Hochul called it a once-in-a-thousand-year weather event caused by climate change.
Friends, this is the new normal. And we in government, working with our partners on the ground, have to work with our communities to build up resiliency, to be prepared for the worst, because the worst continues to happen.
In Arizona, excessive heat warnings remain in effect, with forecasters warning Phoenix is poised to break its record of consecutive 110 degrees plus days. In Florida, forecasters predict heat indexes in parts of the state are set to exceed 110 degrees Fahrenheit or 43 degrees Celsius by the end of the week. A marine heat wave has pushed ocean temperatures off Florida's coast as high as 96 degrees, more than 5 degrees above normal. On Monday, the World Meteorological Organization reported the first week of July was the hottest week ever recorded on Earth. We'll have more on the climate crisis after headlines. And speak with a meteorologist who's quit his job after facing death threats in Iowa for talking about climate change. In the occupied West Bank, Israeli troops shot and killed a Palestinian man Monday, alleging he threw a handmade explosive device at soldiers and fired on them at a checkpoint outside an illegal Israeli settlement west of Ramallah. Eyewitnesses disputed the account by Israel's military, saying 33-year-old Bilal Ibrahim Khada was shot from behind as he drove his car. Witnesses also said Israeli soldiers blocked paramedics from reaching Khada, leaving him to bleed to death. Nearly 200 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli fire this year, including 33 children. In Israel, thousands of people have blocked highways in protest after the far-right coalition led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu renewed its push to dramatically limit the power of the judiciary. Early this morning, 64 members of Israel's 120-member Knesset voted in favor of legislation that would put strict limits on the oversight powers of Israel's Supreme Court. The bill must still receive 2 more votes before it can be written into law. At least 10 sit-in protesters were arrested for nonviolently blocking entry to the Knesset ahead of the vote. This is protester Deborah Galili of Tel Aviv.
What this government is doing is not okay. Democracy is under attack. Israeli rights are under attack. The rights of Israeli citizens are under attack. And we're here to protect that and to say stop the coup, stop the judicial coup.
Israeli and U.S. military forces have begun joint exercises in Israel and over the Mediterranean amidst rising tensions with Iran. The war games include live-fire drills and the mid-air refueling of nuclear-capable fighter jets. In Tunisia, rights groups are urging the government to stop the mass deportation of sub-Saharan migrants and refugees and to provide humanitarian aid to hundreds of asylum seekers who were forcibly rounded up and abandoned by Tunisian authorities at the Libyan border. Footage published by Al Jazeera shows hundreds of refugees trapped in the heavy, militarized, remote region of Ben Gardein at the Tunisian-Libyan border. Many were forced to drink seawater after days without food or fresh water, and those wounded received no medical care. Human Rights Watch has collected the testimonies of dozens who've said they were sexually assaulted or raped, at times facing abuse from authorities on both sides of the border. Tunisia's president, Kais Saied, has denied the reports, claiming the refugees are being treated humanely. Reproductive rights advocates are gathering in Des Moines, Iowa today as the Republican-controlled state legislature is convening a special session to ban nearly all abortions after just 6 weeks of pregnancy. This comes after Iowa's Republican Governor Kim Reynolds called on state lawmakers to return to the Capitol exclusively to pass the new measure. Current Iowa law allows abortions for up to 20 weeks of pregnancy. In Nebraska, a woman has pleaded guilty to providing her 17-year-old daughter with abortion pills last year and then helping her dispose of the fetus. Jessica Burgess admitted to providing the abortion when her daughter Celeste was 29 weeks pregnant. Last year, Nebraska law still allowed abortions for up to 20 weeks. In May, Republican Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen signed a bill banning the procedure after 12 weeks. Burgess is scheduled for sentencing in September. In related news, the Marine Corps is operating without a Senate-confirmed commandant for the first time in more than 160 years after Republican Senator Tommy Tuberville of Alabama again refused to hold a vote on a nominee over his opposition to the Pentagon policy to cover the travel costs of employees forced across state lines to obtain an abortion. Tuberville has for months held up the promotion and confirmation of hundreds of high-ranking generals and admirals, including members of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. In Washington, D.C., protesters are demanding the U.S. government drop its espionage charges against WikiLeaks founder Julian Assange and for his immediate release from a British prison as he faces extradition from the U.K. to the U.S. Ben Cohen, co-founder of the ice cream company Ben & Jerry's, and Jody Evans, co-founder of the anti-war group Code Pink, were arrested in the peaceful action last Thursday. Ben Cohen spoke to the crowd as he set fire to a copy of the Bill of Rights, saying, quote, freedom of the press has gone up in smoke.
If the U.S. is allowed to continue this prosecution, the precedent that it sets is that the U.S. can arrest any journalist of any nationality in any country around the world if they print something that the U.S. doesn't like.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report.
When we think of France, we often picture famous landmarks like the Eiffel Tower and the Louvre Museum and the romantic streets of Paris. The country is known for its rich culture, education system, and art. But what many people don't know is that behind this glamorous facade lies a dark history of colonial exploitation and the lingering scars of French imperialism. France was instrumental in the economic destruction of many African countries and Haiti, implementing policies that ensured they would always depend on France while exploiting their resources. While the nation may now be praised for its architectural wonders, education system, and artistic achievements, few acknowledge the devastating impact it had on the countries it colonized. In this video, we will reveal the truth that has been hidden and forgotten from mainstream media. We will talk about how France ruined Haiti, Guinea, and other African nations. This is not a history lesson, as France continues to exert its control over many African countries, milking them of their resources. We will expose the truth with the hope that France and other former colonial powers face their past and work towards addressing the imbalances created by centuries of exploitation. The extortion of Haiti, once a French colony called Saint-Domingue, is a prime example of French cruelty. The colony prospered by enslaving Africans to work on plantations. France gained immense wealth from this brutal system, but at the expense of countless lives. In 1791, the Haitian people revolted against their oppressors and won their independence in 1804. However, the cost of freedom would prove to be too great, as France won't let its grand prize slip away. In October 1806, the country was split into two, with Alexandre Pétion ruling in the south and Henri Christophe ruling in the north. Despite the fact that both of Haiti's rulers were veterans of the Haitian Revolution, the French had never quite given up on reconquering their former colony. In 1814, King Louis XVIII, who had helped overthrow Napoleon, sent three commissioners to Haiti to assess the willingness of the country's rulers to surrender. Christophe, having made himself a king in 1811, remained obstinate in the face of France's exposed plan to bring back slavery. Threatening war, the most prominent member of Christophe's cabinet, Baron de Vaste, insisted, "Our independence will be guaranteed by the tips of our bayonets." In contrast, Pétion, the ruler of the South, was willing to negotiate, hoping that the country might be able to pay France for recognition of its independence. In 1803, Napoleon had sold Louisiana to the United States for $15 million. Using this number as his compass, Pétion proposed paying the same amount. Unwilling to compromise with those he viewed as runaway slaves, Louis XVIII rejected the offer. Pétion died from yellow fever in 1818, but Jean-Pierre Boyer, his successor, kept up the negotiations. Talks, however, continued to stall due to Christophe's stubborn opposition. Once Christophe died in October 1820, Boyer was able to reunify the two sides of the country. However, even with the obstacle of Christophe gone, Boyer repeatedly failed to successfully negotiate France's recognition of independence. On April 17, 1825, the French king suddenly changed his mind. He issued a decree stating France would recognize Haitian independence, but only at the price of 150 million francs, or around 10 times the amount the U.S. had paid for the Louisiana Territory. The sum was meant to compensate the French colonists for their lost revenues from slavery. Baron de Macau, whom Louis' successor, Charles X, sent to deliver the ordinance, arrived in Haiti in July, accompanied by a squadron of 14 brigs of war carrying more than 500 cannons. Rejection of the ordinance almost certainly meant war. The extortion of Haiti would begin at that very moment. With the threat of violence looming on July 11, 1825, Boyer signed the fatal document which stated, "The present inhabitants of the French part of Saint-Domingue shall pay, in five equal installments, the sum of 150 million francs, destined to indemnify the former colonists." Newspaper articles from the period revealed that the French king knew the Haitian government was hardly capable of making these payments, as the total was more than 10 times Haiti's annual budget. Forced to borrow 30 million francs from French banks to make the first two payments, it was hardly a surprise to anyone when Haiti defaulted soon thereafter. Still, the new French king sent another expedition in 1838 with 12 warships to force the Haitian president's hand. The 1838 revision, labeled Traité d'Amitié, or Treaty of Friendship, reduced the outstanding amount owed to 60 million francs, but the Haitian government was once again ordered to take out crushing loans to pay the balance. Although the colonists claimed that the indemnity would only cover 1/12 the value of their lost properties, including the people they claimed as their slaves, the total amount of 90 million francs was actually five times France's annual budget. The Haitian people suffered the brunt of the consequences of France's theft. Boyer levied draconian taxes in order to pay back the loans. And while Christophe had been busy developing a national school system during his reign, under Boyer and all subsequent presidents, such projects had to be put on hold. Moreover, researchers have found that the independence debt and the resulting drain on the Haitian treasury were directly responsible not only for the underfunding of education in 20th century Haiti, but also lack of health care and the country's inability to develop public infrastructure. Contemporary assessments furthermore reveal that with the interest from all the loans, which were not completely paid off until 1947, Haitians ended up paying more than twice the value of the colonists' claims. The impact of France's actions on Haiti's stability and wealth cannot be understated. This demand for repayment not only perpetuated the cycle of poverty, but also symbolized the theft of wealth from Haiti. In stark contrast to the poverty rates in metropolitan France, where 14.1% of the population lives below the poverty line, Haiti suffers from a dire situation with a staggering poverty rate of 59%. Such extreme economic disparity reflects the consequences of a history marred by exploitation and economic injustice. To exacerbate matters further, the median annual income of a French family stands at over $31,000, a significant contrast to the meager $450 for a Haitian family. These glaring disparities in wealth and income highlight the persistent consequences of stolen labor from generations of Africans and their descendants. The French indemnity, forcibly imposed on Haiti, compounds the nation's economic struggles. This indemnity demanded compensation from a formerly enslaved people to those who had once enslaved them, a situation unparalleled in history. The burden of this indemnity further deepened Haiti's economic woes, making it even more difficult for the nation to escape the cycle of poverty, the sabotage of Guinea. When Sékou Touré of Guinea decided in 1958 to get out of French colonial empire and opted for the country independence, the French colonial elite in Paris got so furious, and in a historic act of fury, the French administration in Guinea destroyed everything in the country which represented what they called the benefits from French colonization. 3,000 French left the country, taking all their property and destroying anything that which could not be moved. Schools, nurseries, public administration buildings were crumbled, cars, books, medicine, research institute instruments, tractors were crushed and sabotaged, horses, cows in the farms were killed, and food in warehouses were burned or poisoned. The purpose of this outrageous act was to send a clear message to all other colonies that the consequences for rejecting France would be very high. Slowly, fear spread through the African elite, and none after the Guinea events ever found the courage to follow the example of Sékou Touré, whose slogan was, "We prefer freedom in poverty to opulence in slavery." When Guinea decided to issue its own national currency in 1960, France organized a sabotage operation known as Operation Persil to destabilize the new country. The operation would base itself on two components, causing economic collapse and causing armed insurgencies against the Guinean government. The operation provided for the Service de Documentation Extérieure et de Contre-Espionnage, based in Senegal, to create large quantities of forged Guinean francs to flood the country with and bring about hyperinflation and economic collapse, similar to the Nazi Operation Bernhard. This would allow the French government to cause significant economic instability. The operation was also to arm opposition figures in Guinea and organize them into paramilitaries that would lead to civil war and the ultimate overthrow of Touré's government. However, the operation suffered a number of leaks, and the Guinea government would be able to stop the operation before it happened. Economic imperialism. When destabilizing former colonies did not give the desired results, the French would use other means to ensure it would hold on to colonies and continue to gain from their resources. Since 1961, France would lay claim to the national reserves of 14 African countries. These countries were all former colonies, including Benin, Burkina Faso, Guinea-Bissau, Ivory Coast, Mali, Niger, Senegal, Togo, Cameroon, Central African Republic, Chad, Congo-Brazzaville, Equatorial Guinea, and Gabon. The CFA franc was created in December 1945 when the French government ratified the Bretton Woods Agreement and became the currency of Les Colonies Françaises de l'Afrique, or the CFA, or French Colonies of Africa. The French Treasury guaranteed the currency under a fixed exchange rate, but would require that the African nation made a deposit of 50% of CFA franc reserves into the French Central Bank, giving France control over the country's resources. The CFA was later split into the Communauté Financière d'Afrique, or Financial Community of Africa, which included the West African countries of Benin, Burkina Faso, Côte d'Ivoire, Guinea-Bissau, Mali, Niger, Senegal, and Togo, and the Communauté Financière de l'Afrique Centrale, or Financial Community of Central Africa, including Cameroon, the Central African Republic, Chad, the Republic of the Congo, Equatorial Guinea, and Gabon. African countries have tried time and time again to liberate themselves from French control, and more often than not, African revolutionaries in former French colonies are met with violent resistance from the French government. The death of Barthélemy Boganda is a perfect example of this. Oganda was the president of the Central African Republic from December 1958 to March 1959. During this time, Oganda cut a lot of ties that the Central African Republic had with France. For example, he founded the Movement for the Social Evolution of Black Africa, a political party dedicated to liberating the French colonies in Africa, specifically the Central African Republic and the French Congo. Oganda was instrumental in the country gaining independence and planned to use his power to liberate other African territories from French rule. In an attempt to stop the Central African Republic's growing independence movement, France arrested Oganda during his 1951 campaign for endangering the peace. He was released shortly thereafter, but he was unfortunately killed in a plane crash in March 1959. The French General Secretariat of Civil Aviation headed an investigation into the crash, yet never publicized their report. The French newspaper L'Express leaked parts of the report that revealed that traces of explosives were found in the wreckage of Boganda's plane. And in response, the French High Commissioner suppressed all copies of L'Express printed in the Central African Republic. Another example is the Cameroonian Marxist politician Félix Roland Moumi, who was killed in 1960 when a French Secret Service agent slipped a dose of thallium into his drink in Geneva. Another Cameroonian leader, Niobe, was shot dead in 1958 by the French military. Sylvanus Olympio, the first president of the Republic of Togo, is another significant African leader that would meet his end because he tried to improve his own country and end the ruthless exploitation of the French. In the 1960s, he would try to take his country out of French control by refusing the Colonization Continuation Pact. However, he would agree to pay an annual debt to France for the so-called benefits Togo got from French colonization. It was the only conditions for the French not to destroy the country before leaving. However, the amount estimated by France was so massive that the reimbursement of the so-called colonial debt was close to 40% of the country budget in 1963. Consequently, the financial situation of just independent Togo was very unstable, and in order to get out of this situation, Olympio decided to leave the monetary system set up by colonial France and created the currency of the country. On January 13, 1963, 3 days after he began printing the new bills, a squad of soldiers supported by France seized and killed the first elected president of independent Africa. Olympio was executed by an ex-French legionnaire, the sergeant of the army Etienne Nasingbe, who, at the same time, received a bonus of $612 from the local French embassy for the success of his mission. Olympio's dream was to build an independent and autonomous country, but the idea did not correspond to the French wishes. Etienne Nasingbe would become president and enforce the monetary system provided by France. Through practices like the CFA franc currency and controlling a large portion of African countries' reserves, France maintains economic control that hampers the growth and independence of these nations. The presence of French military bases in Africa also raises concerns about neo-colonial power dynamics and contributes to political instability. It is important to expose these issues and bring attention to the harm caused by France's actions. The CFA franc, for example, limits the economic choices of African countries and keeps them dependent on France. This dependence restricts their ability to address important social and developmental needs, keeping them trapped in poverty. Moreover, France